Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this podcast, Reinventing Global Health. The episode today is titled Global Health, Can Technology Boost Equity? And my guest is Dr. Grant Miller. Dr. Grant Miller is a professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's a co-faculty member at the Center for Health Policy, Primary Care and Outcome Research. Senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. As a health and development economist based at the Stanford School of Medicine, his overarching focus is research and teaching aimed at developing more effective health improvement strategies for developing countries. His agenda addresses three major interrelated themes. First, what are the major causes of population health improvement around the world and over time? These projects addressing this question are retrospective observational studies that focus both on historical health improvement and the determinant of population health in developing countries today. Second, what are the behavioral underpinning of the major determinant of population health improvement? Policy relevance and generalizability require knowing not only which factors have contributed most to the population health gains, but also why. Third, how can programs and policies use this behavioral insight to improve population health more effectively? The ultimate test of policy relevance is the ability to help formulate new strategies using these insights that are effective. So thank you very much, Grant, for welcoming me in your office. And it's a pleasure to be here with you and to have your opinion and your knowledge, sharing the knowledge about this topic. Do you have anything to add at this point about maybe your background or the country you worked or still working in?
Thanks very much, Jan. It's great to be here with you. I guess not much to add. Maybe the only thing I would point out right now is that I'm not really much of an expert in anything. And I think that if you work in global health and including someone working on global health on the topics I think you have in mind for us to discuss today, I think that as someone that's based at a university in California, working in other countries, it's really important to approach all of this work with a great deal of humility and recognition of how little you know and the importance of deep and equal partnerships with people and many other places. I hope that goes without saying, but I think it doesn't get said enough. So just point it out now.
Oh, that's very true. And, life is a learning process. So here we go. So let's go jump into the first question right away. And from a healthcare perspective, based on your personal experience and also beyond, from what you've learned, what is the current place of technology in global health?
So that's a great question, and we could talk about it a long time. Let me try not to talk about it for a long time. I think you could make a easily defensible argument, and it's my perspective, that the single most important determinant of population health improvement around the world throughout history, as far as we have data to study it, technological progress in health has been the single biggest driver of health improvement. So that would be in contrast to things like rising standards of living that come with economic development generally, or other types of changes. There's still some debate about these issues, but I think that's the most defensible view. So I think it's difficult to understate the importance of technological progress in health, of health technology, for health as we enjoy it today in many countries, and for the potential gains to be realized in other countries that are perhaps behind the frontier today, and for all of us in the future. Maybe just to be a little bit more specific about it, we need to think of technology very broadly. And so I guess in its broadest definition, technology is anything that defines how inputs are transformed into outputs. And so if the output that we care about in our discussion today is health outcomes, then the inputs that go into that, they can be very tangible devices, drugs, things that we might think about more quickly, when we talk about technology, they can be things related to know-how or even management and organizational practices as well that can achieve better health with the same inputs, if you will. Maybe another point I would add on the historical trajectory of population health improvement that supports this claim I started with, there was really a profound exclusion of new knowledge about the fundamental basis of disease starting mid-19th century with the bacteriological revolution. And there wasn't one single breakthrough that really goes into that category, right? There was the emergence of the entire field of microbiology and germ theory of disease, and some innovations that harness that, some technologies, were really simple ones. Even things like the awareness of the importance of washing your hands when you handle food, before you eat, things like this, when you use the bathroom. Then, of course, there are other things, vaccines and curative treatments for different diseases that emerged over a greater period of time, all harnessing that basic knowledge about disease. And some of this has really, you know, cascaded on for a very large period of time. And I think that some of the innovations that followed some of these real scientific breakthroughs are more of these soft types. So there's nothing really high tech about, say, the development of oral rehydration therapy. But at the same time, that was a really critical new health technology that came online mid 20th century that really harnessed a lot of the basic insights that had come from far, far before. So I think big picture, you really can't overstate the case for the importance of health technology in global health. I think that's on average. I think we want to talk some about distribution or inequities too, but on average, I think that's an unambiguous truth.
So what you're saying is actually that technology is the core of global health and the core element of progress in healthcare.
Yeah, and a lot of what people think about sometimes when they talk about global health is really about the distribution of things. These can be services, but really we're talking about the distribution of technologies. Yes. And so without the technologies, the distribution doesn't really make sense.
So there are two types of technology. There's the cheaper one, and then there's the very costly one. And the very costly one is the one that's driving healthcare costs. So what are the positive and negative aspects of technology as a whole?
Yeah, that's a great question and a complex one. Even expensive technologies can be socially worthwhile. So I think we want to be careful about thinking that technologies that are leading to increases in costs are undesirable from a social perspective per se. That's an important area of work. And in some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. Maybe the way I would think about it, because we just talked a lot about the benefits of health technology writ large, I would maybe think about it instead as there are technologies that that can be good, but there are also technologies that can increase health inequality. And maybe this relates some to what you had in mind by talking about expensive ones.
Yes, what I have in mind is return on investment. Like people can say, can argue that, okay, you're going to buy a new CAT scan, but for the price of the CAT scan, you can immunize your entire population. So the choices that have been made in terms of technology. So you see that, and the correlate of this is how much technology is needed.
Okay, all incredibly difficult and important questions. And it will be easy talking to you. Okay, so I think the question of the CAT scan and the immunizations is a hard one because it requires one to draw on social preferences. And it also, in doing that, it also forces one to draw on preferences over redistribution. So certainly, I think you can see the argument that, oh, don't pay for the single expensive thing that one person gets that has some benefit that would be outweighed by the magnitude of the benefits that distributing many other cheaper things that you can buy with the same amount of resources would give you. But, you know, what are the conditions that led to the one person being able to buy the expensive thing in the first place? Well, if there are underlying economic inequalities in a society, and we accept some degree of inequality, that's obviously a very contentious and difficult topic, then allowing people to choose what they value most with the resources under their control doesn't seem like a wrong-headed approach. Then again, we may think that economic resources are not distributed fairly, and that, you know, again, is drawing on some notion of social preferences. And so underlying distribution of resources or abilities to acquire health technology then are very relevant. But there's a related difficult issue, I guess, that I wanted to talk about, which I thought was part of where you were headed here as well, because I don't have a good answer to what our social preferences over redistribution should be. And many people have many different answers. And we talk about that in the political sphere all day long. There are, I guess I'd like to distinguish properties of health technologies that I would describe as intrinsic properties of them. And I would distinguish those intrinsic properties from properties that are related to their distribution. And I say this because I think there's some health technologies that maybe can improve average health, but also increase health inequality. And then I think there are some other technologies that just right from the get-go are effective in reducing health inequalities. And so maybe you think of these as expensive ones and inexpensive ones. So that's an example of the intrinsic properties that may lead a technology to increase inequality. So there are some very, very expensive technologies in the world. They may be socially worthwhile, but they're very, very expensive. I don't think that necessarily means that they're bad for society. I think what that means is that one then, if one is concerned about health inequality, has to pay very careful attention, explicit attention to distributional issues specific to those technologies. You know, and it kind of parallels a very longstanding debate about economic growth. So even if economic growth in some mechanical way increases economic inequality, it doesn't mean that economic growth is bad. It just means that we have to pay really careful attention to redistribution as well. So there are these technologies which, based on their intrinsic properties, are going to increase inequality. Then there are other technologies that I think actually reduce health inequality right at the outset. And I think the cost profile of these is a pretty clear delineator in these types of technologies. So very inexpensive technologies that are accessible to people who can't afford more expensive things clearly has the potential right from the outset to reduce health inequality. I think oral rehydration therapy, which I mentioned, goes into this category. There are other examples that you may not put here, but I think belong. So I think a great example is penicillin. I would say had an intrinsic ability to reduce health inequality from the outset. Maybe not even because it was as widely available to everyone as it should have been, right, when it was developed, but because it substituted for something that otherwise was a big driver of the distribution of sanitary diseases that was even more expensive and even more unequally distributed. So even things like sanitary infrastructure. So when you have new substitutes that come online and they're cheaper than the thing that they're substituting for, they probably have some intrinsic ability to reduce inequality without any overt effort to focus on the distribution per se. But even, I guess the last thing I'll say is even very expensive technologies or expensive to develop technologies can, with appropriate attention, more explicit attention to distribution, reduce inequality. And I think a good example here with pros and cons to it was were all the efforts to distribute antiretroviral drugs in places like sub-Saharan Africa after the turn of the last century. because those were very expensive technologies to develop and they were priced in very expensive ways early on. But there was an enormously concerted effort around distribution. It had some undesirable consequences, if some people have shown, but it also really seems to have been pretty widely distributed to people in need, even though it was a very expensive technology and reduced inequalities and HIV disease burden across countries and within countries.
Well, thank you very much. So I think there are three levels, right, in terms of technology. There is the what kind of technology we're talking about, expensive or cheap. Then the choice of technologies. Well, we have not broached on this, but you mentioned it briefly. It's at the political level. Choices are made, whatever the political system you have. And the third one is the use of technology, because you can use it in different ways that will increase or decrease equity.
All right, more easy stuff. Okay, so let me maybe introduce a couple terms, just so I don't repeat the same jargons over and over again. Maybe let's call technologies that have the intrinsic ability to reduce health inequality, maybe let's call those progressive technologies. And then let's call technologies that, based on their intrinsic properties, increase health inequality, let's call those regressive technologies. So I think that one issue that you're touching on are, like, how are different types of technologies, progressive and regressive, produced? And what are the incentives for producing them? And then I think in a really important issue that you raised that I'd like to come back to after talking about that has to do with not only efforts to distribute, but even how an understanding of how distribution will go might properly inform even the upstream development efforts that take place. So, all right, so let's start with expensive, regressive technologies. So market forces play a huge role in the development of those. And so I think an easy example would be to think about the pharmaceutical industry. So they obviously tend to prioritize the health needs of the wealthy or higher income countries, because those are bigger, more lucrative markets to serve. And that's not a bad thing. That's a market performing the way you want it to. So that creates very strong incentives, or very strong market incentives, to focus on the development of regressive technologies. Then when it comes to progressive technologies, the incentives to develop them are somewhat weaker based on markets. And so you have many other actors that get involved to try to offset the lack of attention that private markets would pay to that. So you have the public sector, you have major philanthropy now. Certainly over the past 25 years, philanthropy has become enormously important. And you might think of international organizations which try to sort of take public or government resources and promote them and focus them rather on more philanthropic uses. I think a challenge in that area is that success is not rewarded as directly as those that have these direct market rewards. So success in producing progressive technologies doesn't have the same immediate reward that producing success in a regressive technology would. But in the last example, decade or so, there have been some exciting developments in the use of trying to focus market incentives to develop progressive technologies. So I think advanced market commitments are really exciting ways that philanthropy, donors, international organizations can get together and say, we would commit to providing a reward to any private innovator that successfully produces a technology that has these very specific parameters. And it's hard because you have to specify the parameters and what have you. But these types of advance purchase commitments have, given us, three new pneumococcal vaccines for low-income countries, right, through an advanced market commitment administered through Gavi in the past decade. And then the commitment becomes to then distribute them at very low or no cost once they're distributed. So we have these market forces leading to regressive health technologies. We have to focus a lot on distribution. Case of antiretrovirals is a good example. We have these non-market actors focusing a lot on the development of progressive technologies. They're finding ways to more cleverly use market incentives to produce these progressive technologies. I think for all the struggle in producing progressive technologies, like good or bad, depending on how you look at it, something that's changing that's important to notice is that the epidemiology of lower and higher income countries is converging. So even though there's still a great deal of work to be done on the infectious disease front and work related to maternal and childbirth diseases, basic nutrition, really you're seeing convergence and epidemiology across countries, high and low income, towards chronic diseases. And I think the good news here is that the efforts, the private market efforts focused on developing these regressive technologies for the needs of high income countries are going to have greater applicability to the health needs of lower income countries too. And that's really going to shift the burden, I guess, in my opinion, even more towards the explicit focus on distribution, because we're going to have more technologies that are needed made for high income countries, but needed in low income countries. And we're really going to have to focus more and more on how to make those affordable and accessible to people in low income countries.
Okay, thank you. Now, a point of clarification, when you talk about success and you talk about the market forces, is success only restricted to financial gain? But in my opinion, there should be other implications, social implications. Are they taken into account?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I think I was misleading there. No, what I had in mind when I said success was really just the successful production of a technology that has health benefits, that's effective, that works.
How do you measure the impact?
Oh, well, that's a tough one. There's a whole industrial complex around impact evaluation now. We have procedures that regulatory agencies in some high-income countries insist upon, right? It's things like the FDA in the United States. The experimental methodologies that are used for some of those evaluations are used in other ways in other countries as well. But there will always be debate about what constitutes sufficient quality evidence. Experimental evidence is sort of the name of the game right now, but that's not the only way to learn about impact. I don't know that you want to go into that whole mess right now. But
I have a question about this. Are they using models to assess the impact?
Sorry, models. Some people do. I don't think so much that too many direct regulatory agencies do. There are bodies, there are international bodies that take evidence that comes from high-income countries and tries to match it to the health needs of, say, lower-income countries. And then based on crossing the epidemiology of the lower-income country and the evidence from some higher-income countries, tries to make recommendations about prioritization in low-income countries. So you might say there's some modeling, if you will, depending on how you define model, involved there. And that could be consequential. So if a lower-income country is receiving advice from an international body about what should go on its essential medicines list, then there's some of this crossing of those two types of things that has to happen sometimes through something you might call a model.
Well, it's a subsidiary question. How is prioritization made? And because, I know in your work, you're talking about generalization. Generalization, well, if you generalize, then you have to have a priority list. So how is technology prioritized?
Well, that's a great question, too. I think there are centralized and decentralized ways of prioritization. So maybe the way to think of this would be you have systems in some countries that make coverage decisions, effectively decisions to subsidize the provision of certain types of technologies. frankly, you know, one tool very commonly used in doing that would be tools in the decision science or cost effectiveness, cost benefit analysis category. Those are centralized decisions. Someone sits down and does some calculations and makes some of those very difficult calls. The decentralized decisions that take place have to do with people taking the resources that they have available to them economically and just deciding based on what they know and what is available at any price in their environment, what they choose, what they prioritize for themselves. And there are very hard preference issues involved in thinking about the pros and cons of both approaches. So a real concern with the centralized approach is that they may really get it wrong in terms of thinking about what one's priorities are. But then again, that's a powerful and important way, especially upchain and supply chains, to make some initial prioritization decisions. But you can see ways in which priorities made in a centralized way can get it wrong, even in health. And I think it's important, again, to approach what people's needs are with a great deal of humility. So one example, I guess, I would give here, there was a lot of discussion maybe, I don't know, a decade or so back, not quite, about efforts in areas with endemic malaria to distribute at low or even no cost insecticide-treated bed nets to people. Excuse me. And then an observation that followed from those efforts was that people were often, people were sometimes observed to be taking nets that were given to them. And of course, it's explained to them what the value of the net is, and what the health benefits are of using it correctly. And instead, they were doing things like fishing with it. And so the concern was, this rampant misuse of these health technologies that are being distributed, their health benefits aren't being realized. I think if you take a step back and really think about what's going on, it's possible that the person deciding to fish with a bed net instead of sleeping under it didn't really have complete information to make the choice that they wanted to make in using the net to protect them from mosquitoes, for example. It's also possible that the needs of the household that received the net are such that fishing is just a greater need for them than using a net to sleep under it. And who are we to say otherwise?
Well, I would agree with this, because malaria has been there for centuries, and it's normal. It's part of the landscape. And the guy, had some creativity, and we're going to use the net to fish because he needs to feed his family.
Or as a source of livelihood.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I think there are these real tensions between centralized and decentralized prioritization. And so this is just an example of how the centralized case could get it wrong, because the agency that has as its mission to distribute bed nets, they're clearly upset about that outcome. But is that bad from a social perspective? Well, it's possible it's not.
Now, the question, using all these assessment methods, I think everybody would agree that potable water and access to water would be a huge return on investment. Yet, it doesn't emerge as a priority of priorities, and it's not implemented in a way that can solve the issues. Because I think we have the economic means to have potable water in developing countries.
Okay, so I think I would point to at least two distinct issues in that kind of challenge. One issue is just simply that there are different incentives and different agencies and actors that all have to make concerted decisions to succeed on doing something about access to clean water or something like that. And they can have to do with also the distribution of resources that these different agencies have, but different agencies have their own objectives, and individuals within those agencies have their own objectives and incentives, and everyone sort of playing along according to the incentives that they have could give you a very socially undesirable outcome. And so maybe one issue is about better alignment of incentives across actors and agencies. I think the other thing is that there's some issues that maybe seem easy that are not so easy, and water could be one of them too, clean water. So if you're not thinking about major infrastructure like you see in urbanized areas, and you're thinking more about rural populations, let's say, where infrastructure maybe doesn't make sense from a cost perspective or is just not feasible, you're really talking about household technologies. And actually, this related to something I wanted to come back to it at some point when you think the time is right, which is about really understanding, maybe it relates to the BedNet example we were talking about a minute ago as well, really understanding the things that users value and what is going to drive their choice. Because, you know, you can, what's the saying? You can provide things to people that would benefit them, and they may not choose to use it, and they can do that for a very good reason.
You can lead a horse to the waterhole, but you cannot force him to drink.
Yeah, you know, maybe horse is not the right way to think about it.
Well,
exactly. So I think that you know, in the case of, say, point of use drinking water disinfectant. So I don't have deep expertise in this issue, but, you know, there are commonly substances like chlorine that are used in them. And it's not that hard to imagine that you may just not want to drink water that always tastes like, you know, to those of us in those swimming pools, you're drinking out of a swimming pool all day long. And that may be enough of a deterrent to keep you from using a technology. And so no matter what alignment you have among agencies and actors to provide point of use drinking water disinfectants that people don't want, you know, it's not going to succeed no matter how much alignment you have. So, you know, that's why I say I think understanding some of these like micro behavioral factors is really important for actually having success in not only in distribution of health technologies, but I think actually they should have sort of full circle implications for the design of technologies. Because if you had that insight, maybe then the right focus for an innovator should not be developing something that is microbiologically better at purifying water. Maybe it should be instead focused on trying to develop a drinking water disinfectant that doesn't taste so bad. And you know, there has been work in this direction, of course.
Yeah.
But those types of insights, if they don't inform the kinds of technologies that are being developed, may lead to technological innovation that doesn't have the impact that it seems like in a strict technocratic sense should.
Well, so this touches upon global health per se, the Organization of Global Health. I mean, there are some international institutions like WHO, but they don't have an implementation power. Their role is limited to making a recommendation. So I think there's a big hole right here. And the second of all is those are political organizations. And as I said before, you know, at the end of the day, it all boils down to politics, political decisions that are made, you know, according to the leaders of each country's benefit and whatever criteria they use. So do you have, okay, you gave me some example about the penicillin, of example of technology reduces reduced equity.
But just to clarify, you were asking me about the sort of cascading incentives to deliver things.
No, I'm asking you, do you have in your experience an example? For example, I remember you worked in Pakistan on the alternative method of warming water and not using wood. This has clearly a benefit to not only to the environment, but all types of other benefits. This is technology, right? This is the use of technology. That benefit, this is a good example of it reduces equity or does it?
I think there are some technologies, if I understand what you're asking correctly, there are some technologies that are not just maybe progressive in the way I was describing before for cost reasons, but they're progressive simply based on the fact that they address a need that doesn't even exist for higher income people. Mm-hmm. And so a cleaner burning cook stove that reduces household pollution and exposure and diseases that are related to that maybe totally irrelevant for a high-income household that doesn't burn biomass, for example, for cooking or heating in their house. So I think that is a very overt, maybe kind of an extreme version of a progressive technology because it's just irrelevant to the higher income people.
It reduces inequity because the children and the family have better health, and therefore they can study better.
You're talking about other sort of additional benefits outside of just health that improving health can have. Yeah, that I think that there is a lot of work that shows that the return to health is very high. And some of the return you can think of is just how much do people intrinsically value better health. And so that's a benefit that they get. But exactly as you say, better health has many other implications, especially if it starts early in age among children for cognitive development and economic prospects throughout life. The ability to reduce poverty due to better health, all of those are there. Frankly, I think the intrinsic health benefits of dealing with inequitable health alone sort of justify it. But I think what you're talking about only redoubles or strengthens the case for investing in health, especially among the lower income or those who are in worse health and the distribution of health. This is actually an argument that agencies like the World Bank started making during the 1990s that, look, they're are good reasons to invest in health, which are not just about health is important intrinsically and we should care about it socially, but it will have other sorts of benefits. There is some debate about like the full extent of the magnitude of the, say, the economic benefits of investing in health. But I think the case for investing in health in areas where health is poor is just really overwhelming.
Yes. But if you look at the development, the 17 goals of the UN and WHO. Health doesn't come, as the number one. And first of all, why so many 17? I mean, and they're all interrelated. And at the end of the day, here we go, I go again with my thing. There is not a single one that says political.
Oh.
And they all the 17 are depending upon political decisions.
Well, the setting of them is political. And, in part because of that, there are not many more, I think, probably than 17, but I think, okay, let me make a connection from before here related to your point. I know that an overarching theme of what we're talking about today is technology for health improvement. And I mentioned kind of at the outset that there are very soft technologies, if you will, that have to do with management. They have to do with incentives or aligning incentives to provide maybe some of the hard technologies that already exist to improve health. And so I think I totally agree with you that I think a key issue, maybe a soft technology issue, if you will, is that you have misaligned incentives between the incentives of those with responsibility in some way for providing health or health technologies and the actual success of improving health that start from the very top political level, and they cascade all the way down to, say, the frontline community health worker level, if you will, or something like that. So you can imagine reasons why a politician responding to electoral incentives might prioritize health if it has some electoral return, but maybe it doesn't have the right electoral return commensurate to its social return. The same could be true, by the way, for non-elected officials that need some other sort of support to stay in their position, whether they're appointed or, even in systems where you have autocratic regimes, you can imagine there's some degree of support that one needs. Then you have incentives, say, in bureaucracies. So those incentives are often very weak as well. So incentives maybe for a senior bureaucrat would be for promotion. So there are career concerns that are very important to the extent that improving health, if you're a bureaucrat in an agency with some responsibility for health, helps your own career, you might focus on it. But odds are there are some other markers or indicators that are going to help you get promoted, which are not totally aligned with just doing what the population being served by a bureaucracy really needs. And you could even imagine the same thing, you know, being true in incentives for individual frontline workers. So there's been a lot of concern with trying to align incentives better. I don't think it's the case that people talk about aligning incentives of elected officials, because that's really meddling in like the constitutional structure of, you know, how elections work in different countries. There is a lot of attention to bureaucrats and other types of agencies and their incentives. And we're not just talking government, by the way. Think about big foundations or donors or international organizations. People there have the same types of incentives. And this is not to judge them. I mean, we all would, right? You want to get promoted, what have you. That's at least part of your calculus and what you do and your job. And so you may want to start something that looks like it's going to have a big splash and you can tell some nice narrative around it, but it may not have been the really thoughtful, well-informed thing. Maybe you didn't take the time to understand the micro behavioral factors that, you know, govern why a household is going to choose to use something or not. You start with a big splash, you make a big deal out of it, and that's enough for you to get promoted. And then by the time the world figures out that the thing you started wasn't really such a good idea, you know, you're off in somewhere else. And so the accountability relationships are very weak in all types of actor organizations and global health. Reforming those, you might think of as a technology, right? There's a management science, you might say. And that type of technology can be really important for global health.
But to me, where the rubber hits the road is the people, the poorest people in the millions and tens of millions of people who are the most needy and voiceless. What kind of incentive is there to do something for them except for moral incentive?
I think sadly you're largely correct. You know, there are large agencies that have ethically focused missions. And so, and on paper, the big foundations might go here, some international organizations. But there is not an accountability framework directly to the most marginalized or needy that you're talking about. And I think that as a result of the lack of accountability, you get this incentive misalignment that we're talking about, because accountability is a way of aligning incentives with the needs of those marginalized people. And if they're voiceless in political systems, if they're voiceless in economic systems, both of which I think are largely true, certainly in extreme cases, then you really are reliant on philanthropically oriented organizations that have all of their own incentive misalignment problems.
Let me ask you maybe the last question or one before last. How do you see the trend in technology and equity in global health? Do you think that overall technology is reducing the gap? And then I have another question. What would be a good strategy to share technology and bridge this gap? So the trend and also the strategy.
Okay, so the trend is actually very hopeful, but whether or not it's due to any purposeful effort, I don't know that we can say. So I think one fact that's fairly well accepted is that at least across countries, there has over time been a pretty strong convergent force in population health indicators across countries over the past 50 years or so. And if that just simply were to continue, then that's a very hopeful thing. I think there's now appropriately more attention to inequality within countries, including in low-income countries. I think in the dialogue around health equity, I think a lot of times here in the U.S., we have domestic U.S. health issues in mind. Those are important, but they're still frankly dwarfed by global inequalities. So, you know, in the United States, life expectancy difference between the top and bottom 1% of the income distribution is about 15 years for men and 10 years for women. And any other subgroup comparison is going to fall within that range. Across countries, the gap in life expectancy at birth is as much as 30 years. There are many countries in sub-Saharan Africa that are still lagging by more than 20 years behind the best health performers. And within lower-income countries, the gap is also in many cases larger than the United States. So it's all to say that the background trends have been positive, but the need is still great. And since we don't know for sure what forces have been driving those background trends, I don't think we can take our eye off the ball, so to speak, and worrying about this in global health. I think that one of the trends we talked about a bit ago was this convergence in epidemiology across countries. And so I think that's potentially an important source of growing inequality if we're not very purposeful about the technologies that we have and are trying to develop to address chronic diseases, because they tend to be more expensive. And if we're not really serious about finding ways to make them widely accessible in low-income countries, that's going to become a really important source of inequality. So I think the distribution plan there is really important. Sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Strategy. How is a good strategy to share technology and bridge the gap between?
Okay, so I have the view that outside of just economic commitment to trying to bridge the gap and improving health equity globally, I have the view that certain types of technologies tend to be more successful universally and successful in reducing health inequality. And this is something that I wish maybe we had talked about more today, but to call it out now, I think that technologies that require less behavior change are ones that tend to be more successful. So, you know, when we think about remaining differences across high and low income countries and health, illnesses related to nutrition is a great example. I spent a lot of time in a collaboration with some partners in different countries and in India, in a specific state with a state government trying to follow a state government's lead to introduce fortified foods into India's public distribution system. And micronutrient deficiencies are still rampant. There have been a lot of efforts to address them by getting people to take, essentially you can think of them as vitamin supplements that contain things like iron. Iron deficiency anemia is one of the huge micronutrient deficiencies. And it can lead to permanent cognitive harm among children, and obviously then their economic potential in adulthood. It's an important risk factor for things like hemorrhage after childbirth, and of course, postpartum hemorrhage is an important cause of maternal mortality worldwide. So I think the promise of something like food fortification relative to the supplementation strategy, large scale, is that you're just asking less of the user. There's less behavior change required on the user's part. People are choosing to eat what they would eat anyway, and you're just making it more nutritious. That's not asking them to do anything different. It may not seem that hard to take a vitamin, but that's more behavior change than just eating what you would eat anyway. And so I think that if we really want to go large scale on promoting health equity, I personally think a real area of focus should be technologies that are progressive, but are progressive in part that also don't require behavior change. So are there technologies like these that are important in our future as we look at greater and greater non-communicable or chronic disease burden? I don't know, but I hope so.
So from this experience in India, how would you rank nutrition in terms of the healthcare needs?
Oh, I think the nutritional need is enormous. And I think it's there's a very hard attribution problem that people work on. But I think the intuition, hopefully I can explain. So there are, if you will, proximate and distal causes of, say, a death. And so the proximate cause the thing that immediately resulted in the death often is a thing that gets written down on a death certificate in places where good death certificates are kept. The proximate cause, though, the distal cause might be the real thing that you want to go after. And you can make arguments about what the distal cause was, but I think good nutrition is certainly part of a distal cause chain. So you might argue that a lot of it has to do with people just being very poor and so not affording good nutrition. But, I guess the point I want to make here is in answering you is that poor nutrition often doesn't kill people because they die of starvation. That's not the main way that nutrition contributes to deaths. Poor nutrition leads to less immune resilience. And the weaker immune system then creates greater susceptibility to causes of death that otherwise your body might be able to fight off. Respiratory infections, diarrheal diseases, things like that. So I think the burden of disease that is attributable to poor nutrition is enormous. I think some of the technical work to make that attribution shows it. I think it's underrecognized, and I think it's underrecognized on the part of policy decision makers, frankly. Of course, it's a dual problem now with the rise of chronic diseases and concerns about nutrition that's not good, but maybe is in turn coming in terms of too many calories or unhealthy foods as well. But many low-income countries still confront undernutrition as a form of malnutrition as well.
Yes, and the problem of chronic disease is not only in developing countries, but also here in the United States, in terms of pediatrics. Children now are suffering more and more of chronic diseases than in the past, and the structure here is not just in the hospital to take care of these diseases. But I had a podcast with Giulietta Gabbiola.
Oh, excellent.
On chronic diseases. And so I refer the listener to that podcast.
Excellent.
How would you like to conclude?
I would just say thank you very much. And it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm really happy that you are organizing this series. And I know that you, like I, would always be happy to talk to any listener that was interested too.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Grant. It was very enlightening, and I think everybody learned a lot from your answers. Although, as you said, you're not an expert, but you're more an expert than everybody else.
I'm really an expert in nothing.
Thank you, everybody, and see you next time.
Thanks again, Jan.